Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 63rd episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, Audiobooks Help Us Understand the World. And on this episode, I was joined by Dr. Phil Whitaker, author of the book, What is a Doctor? A GP's Prescription for the Future. And the book is a vital contribution to the ongoing debate about how we maintain an NHS that is both fit for purpose and free. Using stories and case studies from across his 30-year career as a GP, Dr. Phil Whitaker offers insight into the medical movement's political interferences and societal changes that has transformed the role of doctor over the past three decades. It was great discussing the book with him, and I hope you enjoy the episode. I noticed that the book is in four parts. Why did you decide to divide the book in this way?
Yeah, so, I mean, the title of the book, What is a Doctor? That was kind of the question I was asking myself, really. I mean, I've been a doctor since I qualified in 1990, so a long time ago. And over the course of that sort of three and a bit decades, I've seen a lot of changes in the role of doctor, particularly in general practice, which is my bit of the NHS, but also in hospital practice too. And the book is an attempt to explore the different trends, movements, forces that have created those changes. But I kind of wanted to start out with a first question, well, what was a doctor? And that was kind of what the role of doctor meant to me when I went to medical school way back. So that seemed the logical first place to start. You know, what did I go into the profession thinking I was going to be doing? So that was kind of part one. And then broadly speaking, I think there are kind of some movements in medicine that have created big changes. So I put those into the second part. Then I think there were cultural and political changes that went on that were sometimes to do with medicine, but sometimes to do with wider culture outside. So those were kind of naturally sort of fitting into the third part. And then the fourth part is more about the people that we're bringing into medicine, what we're looking to them to do for the future, for this role that's changed, I think, and kind of look into the future a bit. So I think most people would recognise the NHS in the UK at the moment is in a bit of a crisis time. And some of that crisis, I think, has got its roots in the things that I'm discussing in the book. So I kind of wanted to look forward and sort of chart my kind of vision for where we might go from here to get better. Maybe not go back, but perhaps preserve the good bits from the past and meld them with some things for the future. So those were the four parts, I think, really in my head, were sort of where we started, the kind of things that have gone on in medicine, the kind of things that have gone on in culture and politics, and then where we go from here.
Touch early on how evidence-based medicine is something that affected every aspect of medical practice over the course of your career. But how has the process been hijacked by evidence-dictated medicine?
Yeah, so this is, in a way, the sort of roots of this go all the way through what comes. So this is like the second chapter of the book, really, is looking at this. So essentially, when I was at medical school and starting out in practice, the gathering of scientific evidence to sort of say, well, does this treatment work? How effective is it? How does it compare to other things? That was gathering pace. It had been going on for a while before I came in, but it was gathering pace. And then what sort of happened over perhaps the first decade of my career was that sort of gathering of scientific evidence collided with computerization and the ease of access of information sort of becoming much, much more accessible. First of all, to doctors and latterly to the public, to patients. And governments, I think, well, certainly in the UK, but in other parts of the world as well, started to get interested in variation in medical practice. So one of the things I look at in the book is the way that perhaps in the early part of my career, the treatments you got as a patient with a given condition like a heart attack would vary very much from place to place, just depending on who the doctors were that were treating you and what they believed and how up to date they were. So there was a lot of variation. And the bringing of evidence, scientific evidence, into to sort of inform practice and bring everybody up to the best standard you know, there's no argument about that. That's improved medical practice. So that's what we might call evidence-based medicine or evidence-informed medicine. So rather than me just going off my own whims, I kind of now think, okay, what does the best evidence tell me I should do? So that's a good thing. But then what I think has happened over the subsequent decades is that that evidence base has become more what I call in the book evidence-dictated medicine. So with each individual patient with a certain condition, they're a unique human being. And, you know, maybe perhaps now with something like a heart attack or something, there might be half a dozen medications that the evidence would say, yeah, you should prescribe these to this patient, or there's a certain device you should fit. But that doesn't necessarily apply to each patient because their unique circumstances would be different. And we've arrived at a situation where a lot of doctors very uncritically just apply all the things that the guidelines, the evidence tells them they ought to do. And every patient they just treat exactly the same way. And it's almost like that evidence is dictating what they should do, very often not talking to patients, getting their consent, giving them information, getting them to make choices. So the evidence is kind of dictating what happens. And evidence is it sounds like there's no argument with it, it's evidence, it must be right. But actually, the more you go into it, the more you realize it's quite partial. So producing evidence costs lots of money, doing trials costs lots and lots of money. And lo and behold, the people that have got the money by and large are pharmaceutical companies. So they fund a lot of research. And funnily enough, that research looks at what does this drug do and what does that drug do? So the evidence gets very skewed towards prescribing things or doing things that, funnily enough, generate profits for industry. Now, I'm not a fool. You know, the pharmaceutical industry does a fantastic amount of good, but it's a double-edged sword. And the kind of evidence base that dictates practice is heavily skewed towards drugs. And there's very little funding to look at lifestyle measures, for example, or things that don't generate profits. So that evidence base itself is rather skewed towards things that profit industry. And the culture has become one that sort of dictates to doctors, yeah, do this, do that, do the other thing. And that's the evidence dictated medicine that I talk about in the book, which I think, I mean, there are lots of strands to this book, but again, when I went into medicine, we were starting to get into an era where doctors were, instead of being the kind of, you know, the guru or the expert the patient went to and sort of tugged the forelock and said, this is what symptoms I got. And the doctor said, this is what's wrong and this is what to do. And the patient went away very gratefully tugging their forelock again. We entered a very different era where we were trying to form a partnership with each patient and sort of say, okay, you know, this seems to be what's happening. These are your choices. This is the pros and cons of them. What do you want to do as an individual? And that patient-centered medicine was kind of in the early part of my career, but we've been losing that again through the kind of march of this evidence-dictated machine.
So what has changed the two-way relationship between a doctor and a patient, Phil?
I see it as a kind of almost like a sort of tussle. So through much of medical history, medicine was very paternalistic. The doctor was the authority and the patient was the kind of supplicant. Then there was this kind of movement that was growing up when I first entered medicine that sort of said, no, that's not good. You know, each patient wants to be given information. They want to be part of the decision making about their own health. So that was holding sway and was becoming a very much the sort of dominant movement. But then this, well, I think you can think of it as a juggernaut or a big machine. This evidence dictated medicine machine became stronger and stronger. Governments who started out being sort of worried about variation started to kind of impose their own march or their own perspectives on things. So I know you take a condition like type 2 diabetes, a huge amount of type 2 diabetes going on in the country at the moment. And the evidence-dictated medicine machine turns that type 2 diabetes into a medical condition right from the outset. We prescribe drugs for it. We do lots of tests at regular intervals. We make it into a medical problem. So you've got the evidence-dictated medicine telling you to do these things. You've got governments actually putting money behind that and sort of skewing doctors' behavior to behave in that way, to prescribe and to make it a medical problem. And there are other ways of approaching type 2 diabetes, we're becoming ever so clearer that it's a reversible condition for many people. Not everybody, but we can help many people actually to get free of that. But that's not using drugs. That's not using things that perhaps are being incentivized at the moment. And that might be more about trying to get the patient's voice up again and saying, hey, you know, we could treat this with drugs, but actually, how about if we looked at diet and looked at exercise and supported you in that? Maybe we could reverse this. And if you like, that sort of patient centeredness is getting drowned out by these sort of big forces that say, treat that condition in this particular medical way. And I think that sort of held sway or was holding more and more sway as time went on. And then I think that's been kind of exacerbated in the last few years, partly by, in the UK, by underinvestment. So the health service has got busier. There are fewer doctors. So there's less time to spend with patients. So it's always easier just to reach for the prescriptions. And then COVID itself came in and made healthcare quite transactional. Lots and lots of pent up demand. You know, it's a lot of stuff wasn't dealt with during the pandemic. That's now kind of forming a sort of pent up demand or backlog. So the more busy the NHS gets, the less time doctors feel that they've got to have those time consuming and bespoke conversations with these individual patients. So it's complicated, lots of different factors at play, but certainly the pendulum feels like it's been swinging away from patient-centeredness. And there's more and more people like me in the medical profession and amongst patients saying, hang on a minute, we're losing something that we were getting, which was really valuable. So, you know, the tussle continues. It ain't over yet.
At this point, when I was listening to the audiobook, I think it gotten past the point where you mentioned just how much the introduction of the 111 service changed like the ambulance sector as well. So at this point, I was thinking, is it still an attractive opportunity or job to be a GP, Phil? And what would you say to that question?
Do you know, I still really enjoy it, but I'm lucky because the practice that I work in is very recognisable still for the kind of care that it provided. We provide to that was kind of universal really in the early part of my career, but in an awful lot of practices, that's not true. And actually, I think the answer to your question is there in the statistics. So the numbers of people staying in general practice are going down. So a lot of people are voting with their feet and saying, this is not what I want to do. That's partly people towards the end of their careers. I mean, I'm in the second half of my 50s now, and a lot of people of my age are voting with their feet and going. But also, even more worryingly, I mean, last year alone, about a fifth of all the doctors under 30 that are trained to general practice, so they've done medical school, they've done their foundation training, they've done their postgraduate training in general practice, so 10 years minimum, they were qualified as GPs. And a fifth of them left last year. So the older end of the generation spectrum and the younger end of the generation spectrum voting with their feet and saying, no, this is not for me. And I think that's because we've just been talking about that kind of evidence dictation and the kind of forces against patient centeredness. I think most people that go into general practice are very patient centered. They want to practice that kind of care. The environment's not allowing them to do that. And I think there are other things as well. You know, just the pressure of workload means that you've got less time. It is more transactional at the moment. And the culture in a lot of practices has been directed more towards instant access by government policy. So the idea is that, you know, patients contact the surgery that day, you've got to respond straight away. And that can be important if it's a really urgent problem, but actually something called continuity of care, where a patient and a doctor get to know each other and work together with the problem over time, that's been diminishing and dwindling as the emphasis has been put on access, because you can't have a doctor available every day of every week of every year. And if you prioritize access, then you're sort of saying, well, it doesn't matter who you see, you've just got to see the next available person. Whereas actually continuity, which an awful lot of GPs, that's what lights them up. That's what makes the job for them. And it's what a lot of patients value as well. That's getting squeezed out too. So yeah, I think regrettably, I think it isn't a profession at the moment that many people are wanting to be in. And it's the bedrock of healthcare. It's, you know, the system only works with good general practice. And I think we've seen that in the 111 misadventure, that's in the out of hours setting. That's changed hugely, and very, very few GPs involved in that these days. And the patient experience is very poor out of ours, and that's starting to happen in daytime practice more and more. So I worry.
Another chapter I actually wanted to run by you is the one titled Dr. Google and the AI Revolution. How reliable is apps like GP at Hand? And is it helping or hurting the role of being a GP, would you say?
Yeah, so I mean, GP at Hand is a bit of algorithmic software, basically. That means it starts out by asking you a question, and how you answer that question takes you down a different branch, and then there's another question, and it keeps branching and branching and branching. And GP at Hand is an algorithmic program. Actually, 111 uses an algorithmic program called NHS Pathways to do a similar kind of job. And there are lots of other apps as well that do that kind of thing. They're not brilliant. They can't make a diagnosis. So what they'll end up at the end of their sort of questioning process is an idea of a range of different things that might be wrong, what doctors call a differential diagnosis. But there's no bit of AI or algorithmic software that can actually get you to the diagnosis. And the other thing is that they're all kind of based upon what we call the medical model. So that's the kind of idea that the human body is a machine that's very predictable, and it goes wrong in a certain number of predictable ways. And if you just ask the right questions, you'll get to the answer. But actually what we see in general practice all the time is how much people's emotions, their psychology, their relationships, their work, their income, their job security, their job insecurity, all impact on health. And all those things create physical symptoms that they come and talk to us about. And none of these apps or bits of software can even begin to scratch the surface of those other things that impact on people's health, their experience of symptoms, which is what we do day in, day out in general practice. So the apps are biased towards those easy diagnostic labels and don't reflect the complexity of what we call biopsychosocial medicine. So that's the kind of stuff I do. It's where biology, that's the medical model stuff, meets psychology and emotions, and where it meets people's living circumstances, the social and the economic aspects of their lives. And I think those apps have probably on the whole really contributed to a big problem, which is that for a lot of politicians who perhaps find themselves, like Matt Hancock being Secretary of State for Health, he looks at this GP at Hand app and goes, oh wow, medicine's really simple. You just pop in some questions, you swipe some answers, swipe left, swipe right, and then you get your answer. So we don't need doctors anymore. We've got apps to do that. And it's created this sort of sense that medicine, diagnosis, care is just reducible down to sets of questions, which it just is not. So I think on the whole, they've taken us to a pretty unhelpful place.
Yeah, I'm paraphrasing, but I remember a part in the book where you essentially say that AI is a tool that's meant to support doctors, not replace them, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, in the way that I say, look, the pharmaceutical industry, incredibly helpful, but it's got its downside. AI, incredibly helpful in certain circumstances. So, you know, it's already helping us to churn through things like scans or cervical cytology or big sets of data to find patterns or pull out things that need further attention. So very, very helpful in those big data problems. But it's a tool. It doesn't replace the human being, the doctor relating to the patient, putting the context. What does this actually mean for the individual patient? So AI is, you know, an MRI scanner or a CT scanner, you know, these are incredibly powerful tools, but they're tools that help doctors in their task. And that's what AI actually is and what it will be. But I think, unfortunately, we've been through a bit of an era where particularly the politicians looking for cheaper solutions to how to run a health service got very excited about the fact that these bits of technology could actually replace expensive human healthcare professionals. But that was never going to happen. And, you know, I think we are probably exploding that myth, although it keeps rearing its head again, I'm afraid. Yeah.
the back of that, I wanted to ask you about the importance of patient-centered consulting. What are your thoughts on ICE, Phil?
Yeah, so ICE is, I'll just explain the acronym. So that stands for ideas, concerns, and expectations. So basically, any of us, whoever we are, if we get ill, we are going to have ideas about what's wrong, concerns about the worst case scenarios, and expectations as to what a doctor or a nurse or a physiotherapist is going to do when we go and see them. And for almost all of medical history, most doctors or nurses or physiotherapists, for that matter, didn't really pay any attention to that at all. They were the experts, the patient came along, they just opined on what was the problem and what to do. And ICE is really the foundation, that's the bedrock of patient-centered consulting. So the idea is, as well as me kind of coming to a diagnosis, thinking, okay, your chest pain is because of this, I also want to find out what your ICE are, what your ideas, concerns, expectations are. And if I can do that, number one, I can address those so I can put your mind at rest. So if you came with chest pain and I thought, do you know what, that's acid coming up from your stomach and I'm going to give you some Gaviscon and that's going to help it. If I don't understand that actually you're thinking this is exactly the kind of symptom my dad had in the weeks before he had his fatal heart attack, and I don't get that out and I don't address that, you're going to go away thinking, I know doctors get things wrong sometimes. Maybe that guy just didn't think about the heart thing, and you're still going to be worried. And it's a very basic idea, a very basic example, but you know, if I can understand what's in your mind, then I can serve you much better. But also, again, you know, perhaps a patient coming along with joint pain, you know, I might sort of say, oh, it's earlier osteoarthritis. Here, have these painkillers. Because I think that the patient's come along wanting some painkillers. But actually, maybe they've got a completely different worry. Maybe they think, this is going to stop me playing football. I love my five-a-side, and am I going to have to stop doing that? And again, if I don't understand that's their concern, then I can't sort of talk to them and say, no, actually, it's really good to keep physically active, keep the muscle strength up. So I can make lots of assumptions about what that patient wants. And I don't do a good consultation if I don't find out what it is they're actually concerned about and what they're expecting. So, yeah, it's the bedrock of a very different style of medicine that's unique to each patient. It's not just about the diagnosis and the treatment. It's about that patient as a unique human being. What do they need? What do they want? What are they concerned about? And the process is about melding the two things together. So it's not about a patient coming again. I've got back pain, I'd like a scan. And I go, okay, I'll get you a scan. You know, I've still got a job to do there. I've got to sort of say, actually, does a scan help you? Is that a sensible use of resources? Is that a sensible use of money? But if I can start to understand why they think they ought to have a scan, that what are their ideas about that? What are their expectations? Then I can hopefully address those, and we'll try and kind of come to a shared understanding of what the problem is. That's partly my approach as a doctor and partly their approach as the unique patient. And if we can get the two joined together, everybody's happy.
Lastly, what I wanted to ask you is, in terms of the future, what concepts should be introduced to undergraduate medicine education, and are you optimistic for the future as well?
Okay, so let me take those in two parts. So the things that we ought to be introducing, so you know, we talked earlier about evidence. There's just tons and tons of evidence out there now, and it's all sort of, you know, making a very good case for prescribing this drug and doing that test, etc. So we could say that that's what can be done. In any given scenario, the evidence tells us what can be done. And at the moment, we're in the grip of what I call evidence-dictated medicine, and people too uncritically just say, that's then what should be done, and they just apply it. And I think what we need to do in medical education, a bit as an undergraduate, and certainly in postgraduate training, is to get a very different approach back again, which is where evidence-based medicine started, which is saying, this is what can be done, but actually for that one individual patient, what should be done? And to work out what should be done for that person, we've got to do a patient-centered consultation. We've got to apply the sweep of that evidence to that one individual, got to negotiate, got to find out what they value, what's important to them. the earlier we can do that. I mean, I train a lot of younger doctors. They're very, very wary of going off a guideline. If they don't do all the different things on the guideline, they feel they could be sued, they could be criticized. We need to be saying, no, actually, you don't have to do all those things. That's all the tools you got in the toolbox. But you've got to work with your individual patient to see which tools in that situation does that patient actually want to use. So getting that idea of that, you know, we want evidence to inform practice and patient-centeredness back, we've got to get that there into medical training. And in part, there's a kind of a reprofessionalizing of medicine that goes on there as well, where we've got to get confidence back in doctors to say a guideline is not an absolute tramline. It's just there to give you information to share with your patient. So that's a big culture shift that we've got to have, and getting back to those ideals of patient-centered consulting. So if we can get those things, then I'm optimistic. And partly that's to do with training, getting the training. And actually, I think that it's there. The medical curricula are more and more focusing on that. They're also sort of focusing not just on the drugs, but also on lifestyle things. You know, there's more and more of that in undergraduate medical education. So these are all good. Where I have some pessimism is that those things take time. So it's quick to assume what should be done for patients and just to dole out stuff on a guideline. It's time consuming to share all that information with your patient, to negotiate with them, to find out what's in their minds. That takes time. And for that, you need plenty of people so that they've got caseloads that they can spend the time. And I think that there's been a trend, particularly in general practice, to see GPs, doctors in general practice as expensive. And if you replace them with apps or perhaps professionals with less extensive training, it seems like you're going to save some money. So this seems to be the answer. But I think it's a false economy. I think that leads to poorer care. It leads to much more expensive in the system, because if I'm dealing with a patient with all the years of experience and training I've got, I can very often deal with things myself without doing lots of tests, without lots of referrals, without involving specialists who are at the very expensive end of the system. So I think we've got to recognize that actually, if we invest in the people at the beginning of patients' journeys, that's where we get best care for them, but also where we get best value for the system. And I think that's an argument that's still not been won yet. And I think if we win that argument, we'll get investment in primary care in general practice. We'll get more people back doing the job. The job will become enjoyable again. You know, we were talking about people voting with their feet because they don't enjoy the job as it's become. Well, if we can restore the job to what it was and what it still is in practices like mine, thank God, you know, if we can get that across the NHS, then I think that's the magic bullet that will start to turn the experience of patients and the health service around. So I'm guardedly optimistic we can win that argument, but we haven't won it yet, I don't think.
That was Dr. Phil Whittaker, author of the book, What is a Doctor? A GP's Prescription for the Future. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to Phil for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next.